This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. P.T. Duderman grew up a military kid and followed that path when it was his time, spent 26 years in the Navy and then working for the government. Says he learned a lot and he saw a lot as a captain in the Navy and an arms control specialist on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. When that career ended, P.T. took up writing, based his work on his experiences from inside to create military fiction novels. He's published 18 books now and resides in Rockingham County. Cold Frame is his latest title. It is a government drama in the age of counterterrorism. P.T. Duderman, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
So this is Cold Frame, a kind of cloak and dagger thriller with the terrorist kill list, a D.C. cop who finds himself in the middle of it all. Give us a little more of the plot.
Some poor D.C. cop catches what looks like an accidental death, not a homicide at all, but it turns into one. And as he investigates it, he finds out that the individual involved is part of the Washington Federal Counterterrorism Bureaucracy, which is enormous. There are over 85 agencies in Washington alone dealing in counterterrorism. He begins his investigation and begins to be rebuffed by the very people that ought to be very curious about what happened to this medium senior bureaucrat. And that piques his interest, as it would any good cop. And the story is what happens when he actually probes and comes up against the heart of darkness, if you will, of the counterterrorism world, which is a committee that decides whose name goes on the kill list. And we were going to call the book The Kill List, but that's not really what it's about. It's not about the list. It's about the people who generate the list and who put names on it and who compete sometimes between the various agencies to put names on it. The committee meets periodically. They select one name after an all-day session where they challenge the nomination, if you will. Is this guy serious enough to warrant the federal overseas assassination program? And if the name makes it to the list, then the president signs off on it. And as I say in the book, the drones from Arkansas launch into the night and fly overseas. And that's basically what the story's about. And what you get to see in it is how Byzantine this counterterrorism bureaucracy is, how it does work, how it doesn't work, how competitive it is amongst the various agencies for political influence, budget, money, bragging rights, all of the above. And at the center of it is the man who runs the committee and runs whose name actually gets on the kill list.
All right. Now, we've already established your credentials. You've got long experience in the military as an arms control specialist as well. You've got some inside information. You're a fiction writer.
This is a novel. That's correct.
So how much of this stuff is for real?
Gosh, I wonder. I think probably my major talent as a writer of this kind of stuff is that I can make it sound like it's absolutely authentic. And the truth is, some of this is absolutely true. If I can't figure out how to go with a particular aspect of the book, I make it up.
That competition, I mean, let's talk a little bit about that, because that is something that is certainly anybody who's spent any time at all in Washington, D.C., understands that it is about career individuals, if you want to call them bureaucrats, who are adept. You don't get to Washington, D.C. at those high-level jobs if you haven't figured out how to navigate that system. And they're also dealing with national security, and they take it pretty seriously. But what part competition and what part sort of earnest, you know, concern about national security, do you think?
In my opinion, it goes back to what they used to have in the Saturday Evening Post. Now, I'm dating myself a little bit. But there used to be an advertisement for carpet, and it said, if you have a title on the door, you have a Bigelow on the floor. And that meant your status in the corporate offices. If you had a Bigelow on the floor, you were somebody. And I think in Washington, being somebody, being a player, somebody of influence, a go-to guy, name it what you will, is almost more important than the actual substantive work you're supposed to be doing. You will protect, as they say in Washington, your rice bowl, which is your remit within the government, from anybody else getting a hold of it or getting some of your budget money or some of your influence or your Bigelow on the floor.
The name of the carpet, by the way, Bigelow carpet. Yeah.
Yeah, and that drives, I think, more than the substantive name on your agency door.
And I think what your book illustrates is where those two worlds don't connect is a police officer conducting an earnest investigation into an honest-to-God homicide, how that would go normally, and what happens when it brushes up against this other world, some of which has to do with the security that is native to counterterrorism and other, some of it has to do with protecting our careers.
Certainly. And the people who actually do this, I think, are God-fearing, good, hard-working people, particularly if they've seen the threat face-to-face. If you've seen, as we all saw, 9/11, I think the major shock of 9/11 was America got to see what this looks like. As somebody in Damascus, he's been living with it for his entire life, probably, or in Israel. But this story sort of reveals how the counterterrorism people have evolved into something quasi-malignant now because they have police powers. They can come pick you up at your house, no warrant, no knock on the door if they choose not to, and take you away and put you somewhere. And I have an instance of that in this book where the police officer gets picked up, and he doesn't know who's picked him up. And he says, I need to call my boss. He calls his boss, and the boss says, it's okay. This is for your protection. That's what I've been told to say. Now, that's scary.
Well, and this was a story that a few decades ago you wouldn't set in the United States.
Right.
You'd set this story in some exotic, far-flung totalitarian regime.
Berlin comes to mind,
yeah.
In the 30s.
Yeah, exactly. Some place where lawlessness is the order of the day, or where totalitarian order is the end of the day. Which brings us to this question, because you grew up, well, we spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C., many years there, right?
Right. Both in my Navy incarnation as a child, and then when I worked for the FAA after I got out of the Navy for about 3 years, because I did not want to work for the Defense Department, having just cut the ties. You know, I didn't want to turn around and come back into my old office.
Tell us how things have changed, you think, especially since 9/11.
The most visible change in Washington to me is the atmosphere. I went up to research this book because I hadn't been there for about 10 years. And I had a friend drive me around the city because that's a blood sport, driving in Washington,
yeah,
D.C.
Yes, it is.
And I wasn't up for it. We went, one of the places I wanted to see was the Department of Homeland Security headquarters building, which was housed in what used to be the U.S. Naval Communications Security Station up on Western Avenue. And we parked across the street from the main gates to this old Navy brownstone building headquarters. I got out of the car and I took a picture of the gates because I wanted to just have that in my mind as if I went there in the book, what did that look like? The moment I stood up with a camera, three guards came out of three separate guardhouses, mm-hmm. one that I saw, two that I didn't see, with weapons. They didn't point the weapons at me, but they made it very clear, we are watching you. Cameras on top of the gates were pointed at me. Cameras that I probably couldn't see were pointed at me. And then I got back in the car and I told my buddy, let's boogie, you know, let's get out of here. This is scary.
Yeah.
You go downtown and the main monuments are still pristine, but any government office building is armed to the teeth. We pulled up to adjust our Garmin. We were trying to find a street, and I couldn't remember where it was. He didn't know where it was. We're sitting in a no-parking zone, admittedly, both of us cranking around on a Garmin, and we get a rap on the window. And here is a female traffic cop with what looked to me like an AK-47. I mean, it was an assault rifle. She taps on the window with the barrel of the rifle and says, you cannot park here. I said, we're just trying to adjust the Garmin without getting into a traffic accident. You have 30 seconds. Yes. She backed away and stood there looking at her watch. At the end of the 30 seconds, she put her hand down and repositioned the rifle like, I'm serious. You will go to jail. We will pick you up. Something will happen. We got out of there. And that is a strange atmosphere for the town I grew up in.
Well, that leads to the question of doing the research for this book. I mean, be kind of scary asking the questions you had to ask of the people you had to ask them of, given right. the fact that there are people now in our nation's capital with AKs telling you you've got 30 seconds to move.
Right, right. Well, I stayed across the river in Crystal City and took a walk one night across Memorial Bridge and into the mall area. Mm-hmm. It was a lovely night. I was tired of being in a hotel. And I also wanted to see what it looked like at night. And what it looked like at night were all the tourist buses were parked and empty. And about every tenth of a mile was a great big black Expedition SUV with guys sitting in it. And as I walked the full length of the mall, 2 miles up, 2 miles back, they were all looking at me and I was looking at them. They're all just sitting in the car. You look up at the Washington Monument. The Washington Monument used to have these giant searchlights that pointed at the monument. Now, up at the top, they have four giant searchlights that point down, so you cannot see what's up there looking down at you. It's very different.
It is a very different place. So that leads me to this question about your research with the police. Obviously, this police officer, the investigation is critical to the book. And how much research did you do there? Washington, D.C. police, clearly they know they're in a different place. They have different set of rules and communications going on all the time with these various security agencies. Did they talk about that, how different it is to be a police officer in
D.C.? Well, my guy is in an office of the Metropolitan Police Department, Washington Metro Police, called the ILB. Now, you got to understand about Washington. If you don't speak in acronyms, nobody can understand you. It's the Internal Liaison Bureau. And what their job is if they get a case that bumps up against federal law enforcement, Metro Police would like to hand it over to the nearest accommodating federal agency, FBI, Federal Protective Service, Secret Service, anybody who will take it. Now, the guys who get assigned to this lovely job are people who are not superstars in the Metro PD for whatever reason. They've been moved out of their office for getting in trouble with their boss or for whatever problem. And the office is called, familiarly within the Metro PD, the Briar Patch. And in the Briar Patch, they handle tar babies. And a tar baby is an issue or a case that is so complicated and involving so many different agencies, it's never going to be solved. My clearance rate in my office is never going to go up if I deal with this. So we shop it down to ILB and let those poor guys see if they can deal with it. So the humor in the book are the four characters in the Briar Patch, and they are characters. And that's the fun of it, because when they go up against the counterterrorism feds, who are all serious all the time, they have some fun.
The Good Soldier's Fajek, Czech piece written in the early part of the 20th century that did the same thing, kind of fumbling guard. And that's in many ways what this seems like. Tell me about the real Briar Patch. Is it something like we give it to you in order to this unit because we know it's part of a federal investigation, we don't want you to solve it, or is it just...
It's not because they don't want to solve it. And frankly, I don't know if the Briar Patch exists or not. But it does exist within the military services. Each of the military services has an office like this for problems that are such hard nuts to crack that they ship it off to these guys and say, sell it. Sell it to anybody. And quite often the counterterrorism people are willing to buy it, if you will, mm-hmm. because often what's happened is there's been a screw-up. And rather than have the Metropolitan Police Department plus a Washington Post reporter having their eyes on this, we'll take care of this for you, little brother. And they pull it into the counterterrorism world. Somebody gets fired, somebody gets disciplined, or not, and it disappears. And it's no longer my Metro Police Department problem.
Sadly, you might also have to find a suspect where there was none.
Yes.
In order to justify the whole thing. So we're talking about Cold Frame. P.T. Deuterman is the author. How you talked, too, about the security apparatus, how things have gotten much scarier and much darker and much more Kafkaesque in our American life these days. But it's also a scary world we're living in. You know that from your world, doing arms negotiations. And, in fact, you had an experience where you had to inspect chemical weapons facilities and you kind of got the scare of your life, right?
Really and truly, the most spooky thing I did was go to the U.S. Army Medical Institute for research on infectious diseases. That's a mouthful. USAMRID in Washington speak. It's run by a veterinarian. I didn't know that. A colonel in the Medical Service Corps, veterinarian. And this is the place where they develop countermeasures to biological weapons. If the bad guy throws an anthrax bomb, what do? Flop and twitch, or do we have clothes that we can wear, masks that we can put on? Do we have detectors? Yeah. And one of the companies I worked for was making detectors for biological. This is a detector that can pick up bacteria and determine, whoops, that's a bad one, and sound an alert. And in this laboratory, they dealt with Ebola, HIV, plague, I mean, horrible stuff. And they had BL4 containment, which is super, super containment. And I was supposed to love this program. I did not love this program. You know, used to was, we made some of that stuff too. We knocked all that off back in, I think, 1978, chemical, biological, and radiological. But for a naval officer going out to sea in the pristine world of the ocean, chemical weapons, biological weapons, I lifted a rug I didn't want to ever do again.
Well, here you've had this experience in the real world, both as an arms negotiator on the, with Joint Chiefs of Staff and the arms as an arms control specialist, not a negotiator, but a specialist in the Navy and in private business, working in all these areas that show us we're living in a scary world. You write a novel that also says, you know, it certainly leaves you with the feeling that what we have done to counteract this is just about as scary. And I wonder what you think about sort of how do we cope with all of this? How do we not become the enemy? And we're on a very, very slippery path to becoming the very thing we fear and still protect ourselves.
There's a comment in the book in a conversation between one of the people who end up helping the policeman where the president, not the president himself, but the advisor that the policeman's talking to, says the president makes the call as to whether or not somebody goes on the list. And it turns out that the first guy, first of two homicides in the book, is an individual that is actually anti the kill list and is working with some people in the U.S. Senate to shut it down. And his boss is not thrilled with that. And the advisor to the policeman says, you know, that could work both ways. Enemies of the state or enemies of the president, could it not? And the fellow he's talking to has nothing to say because there's nothing to say.
Right.
And in fact, that's what's going on in the book.
Right.
And that's what makes it serious.
Right, because sometimes people are simply protecting their careers, and because they can work under the cloak of secrecy and always chalk it up to national security,
correct,
we don't know who they killed and why, and that lack of oversight is one of the scariest things.
Yeah, do not become entangled with them under any circumstances. And, you know, as a novelist, I use Google a lot. I can do research that I could never do before. I can look at places I've never been to before. You do enough of that and you'll get a phone call saying, what are you doing?
Yeah, I wondered about that.
What are you doing? I had one book where I had a guy making a bomb. I talked to some chemists and they said that would never work, but it sounds like it would. So I used it because I don't want to provide a cookbook.
Right.
And so we made this bomb and I got a call.
From whom?
I don't know. I don't know.
What did they say?
I work for the U.S. government, and you are doing research on a gas bomb, a hydrogen gas bomb, not a hydrogen atomic bomb, but hydrogen gas bomb. And what's that all about? And I said, Google me. He said, go on hold. I went on hold. He came back on the line and said, thank you. Click.
Wow.
They're watching.
Somebody is.
Now, is that all bad? Not necessarily.
P.T. Deuterman, my guest. He spent 26 years in the military and in government services. He has since become an author of military fiction. Latest book, Cold Frame. It's now out. It looks at American government today in the age of counterterrorism. P.T., what a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking to us.
I'm delighted to be here, and thanks for having me.
There's more ahead on the State of Things. Stay tuned.